Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Nisarg. He's a wildlife biologist studying otters in India. He's walked and paddled along streams and rivers for close to a decade and hopes to do the same for the rest of his life. He believes the lives of otters, the river, and his own life are inextricably linked and uses otters and rivers to talk about larger environmental issues and also his own struggles with mental health. He lives in the city of Bangalore with his dog Noah, who is as close to wilderness as he can get while in the city. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, Derek. Thanks for having me on the show.
So can you talk about the otters of India? Just give us an introduction to them.
All right. So India has three species of otters of the 13 found across the world. And I'll just list out the three. One, you have the smooth-coated otter, which is the largest of the otters found in India. You also have the Eurasian otter, which is found across a much larger geographical range. And then lastly, you have the small-clawed otter, which is actually the smallest otter species in the world. So you have all of these three species, kind of some overlapping in some places, distributed in other places as well.
So how big is the largest otter and how small is the smallest otter there?
Okay. The smooth-coated otter, which is the largest, could be 15 to 18 kilograms, like a medium-sized dog. The smallest otter, which is the small-clawed otter, will be less than 5 kilograms. It's just like a large furry rodent, actually. Yeah.
So do these otters overlap in range?
Yes. So from what we know, the small-clawed otter, which is the smallest one, is restricted to the hills and the mountains and the foothills. They mostly need shallow streams, fast-flowing streams, rocky habitat, because their diet primarily consists of crustaceans. So they eat a lot of crab, and it's easy for them to hunt crab in shallow waters. Whereas the other two, that's the smooth-coated otter and the Eurasian otter, I'll actually talk about the smooth-coated otter, because their prime habitat would be the river and the plains, the meandering, slow-flowing, deepish, murky waters in the plains. Also, the Eurasian otter is something more of an enigma in India, at least. We know very little about it, and very recently, after a period of 6 or 7 decades, we had evidence of it, unfortunately, from a roadkill. So the Eurasian otter, we know very little about, but it's got a really wide distribution, going all the way from the sea level on the east coast to the Trans-Himalayas in close to maybe 5,000 meters above sea level.
And I was going to ask, so far as I know, in the United States, there are sea otters and then river otters.
Right.
And I was going to ask, why would there be three species of otters with overlapping range? And then I thought about coyotes and wolves and how they're both canids, but they overlap. So is it similar? I mean, how does that work when you have – I take it they fill different niches ecologically.
Yes. So when I say there's some overlap, it's not that all three are found in all habitats. For example, the small-clawed otter and the smooth-coated and Eurasian otters have a small zone of overlap. And the small-clawed otters primarily – the diet is considerably different from the diet of the other two. Diet is crustaceans, whereas for the Eurasian and the smooth-coated, it's primarily medium to large-sized fish. Again, where the Eurasian and the smooth-coated otters differ is that Eurasian otters, I believe, occur at a much, much lower density compared to the smooth-coated otter, which can reach pretty high densities in the plains. And the Eurasian otter is probably the more forested species of the two large otters here, whereas the smooth-coated otter is very commonly found in the plains, in the agricultural landscapes, as well as large rivers and backwater lagoons.
So can you talk for a moment about the evolutionary history of these? Do we know how long they've been there? And also, prior to industrialization, were they very common, and how has that affected their populations?
Yeah. Otters have, well, thought to have radiated from the Orient. So Southeast Asia is where otters actually evolved and moved out. And in India, they've occupied these habitats for a fairly long period of time. Well, there used to be, I can talk about the smooth-coated otter here, and they used to be very, very common prior to maybe 4 or 5 decades. And in the intervening period, they have largely disappeared from much of the range, primarily due to poaching for their pelt and meat. They are now probably extinct in many of their range countries. The place where I work in South India is probably the last stronghold. Some of the rivers here have very good populations of smooth-coated otters. They're fairly easy to see. Poaching still hasn't driven them to extinction here. But in many river basins in many countries, these otters are extinct, primarily due to poaching. But there are other threats as well, like industrialization, intensive agriculture, and a far more insidious threat, which is actually mining for sand from river beds.
So it seems kind of clear, but can you make it really obvious how, can you be explicit about how and why mining for sand harms otters?
Sure. So just to give a bit of context here, a lot of our cities, urban centers, highways, all sorts of infrastructure development needs a lot of sand. And at least in India, and probably it's true for a lot of areas in Southeast Asia, the sand mostly comes from riverbeds. This is sand that's washed down every monsoon. So when people start excavating sand from the riverbanks and the riverbeds, they change the fundamental nature of our rivers. So sand plays a very important role in regulating flow, preventing erosion, creating habitats for otters and fishes and numerous other forms of life. So when people go mine sand and remove sand from sandbanks, sandbanks play a very critical role for otters. Sandbanks are where otters socialize, groom themselves, play also as territory marking. So sandbanks have largely disappeared. When they remove sand from the riverbed, they're changing habitat for lots of species of fish that need sand on the riverbed to even lay eggs and find space in. So sand, along with the rivers, the sand in the river plays a very, very important role for a lot of these life forms. And sand mining here is of such a scale, it's just too intensive, primarily because it's highly lucrative. There's a lot of money to be made. It's highly, highly unregulated. So a lot of the sand mining you see in India is illegal. But also, a lot of the sand mining is mafia-controlled. Ordinary farmers or fishermen find it very hard to confront sand mining. So there's a lot of socio-legal issues, but there's also a lot of environmental issues that sand mining gives rise to.
And I just want to point out for our listeners that if you see a skyscraper, it's basically sand held in place. And if you see a dam, I mean, that's what a dam is made of sand, basically, or a sidewalk, any of that. Anything we see in a city is made of a lot of sand.
Yeah. So I keep saying that all our lifestyles in the city, be it the houses we live in or the pavements we walk on, is fundamentally altering how otters and fishermen interact 100 kilometers away along the river. So our demand for good lifestyle in metros or urban centers directly impacts how otters relate to everything around.
So let's back up for a second. And you talked about some otters living in a fairly, I don't remember the word you used, but it was they're being, they live in higher densities than others.
Yes.
What would be in a healthy, of the different species, in a healthy population, what might be a density of along a river or stream? Is it like one per mile, or is it, I have no idea what it would be.
Right. So, well, tropical rivers are very productive in terms of prey for otters. So the river in the plains is by nature very productive, both for otters and also for people. That's why they settled so intensively. I would say for every 10 kilometers of the river in the plains, you would have at least one social group of smooth-coated otters, which could be anything between 6 to 10 otters in the family group. So that's fairly high density. That's also mostly where, mostly in the plains, where otters haven't been poached out.
So can you talk about their social organization?
Well, yeah. So there haven't been any, studies looking at how otters interact socially within the group, but at least from what we can borrow from other species, they thought to have one dominant pair, which is the male, breeding male and the female, and all other members of the group are thought to be related to these two. So they breed every year seasonally, give birth to young. The other members of the group can help guard or raise these pups, and these pups and the suberils go on to leave dispersed from the group the next couple of years. So it's primarily a breeding pair and related members.
And do they, I'm sorry for my ignorance, but do they dig burrows and give birth underground?
Yeah, so they typically dig burrows in the soil or in vegetation. They can also use tree roots and existing rock dens along riverbanks and on islands in the rivers. Fairly thick undergrowth, with they're not easily seen from the outside. They're not obvious. Yeah.
And in excluding poachers, I have two questions. One of them is, who are some of their primary predators? And also, what are some of their, what, and I hate to talk about it in a utilitarian fashion, but what functions do they play in their natural communities and their ecosystems?
Right. Well, poaching is the single most direct threat to otters anywhere, probably for most species. But in the natural system, ecosystem, the adult smooth-coated otters probably don't have any predators. They share the river with mugger crocodiles, which also are fairly large, but these otters, being social animals, are known to often harass these large crocodiles into leaving the area. So there are lots of footage and incidents where people have seen otters chasing away or biting crocodiles. So crocodiles are not such a big threat to these animals that live in groups. Sorry, I forgot. Oh, yeah, I remember that. So actually, yeah, I often don't pay so much attention to what their function in the ecosystem is, because they all have a role to play. But otters being top predators in these tropical rivers directly influence everything that come below them in the trophic pyramid, be it communities of fish, different species of fish. Mention here that otters belong to the family of the mustelids, and mustelids by nature are these true carnivores that need to really hunt to meet their high metabolic requirements. So otters will hunt every day. They need to hunt fish every single day, and just because of this fact, they directly influence the communities of fish found in the habitat, and that in turn flows down the pyramid.
So I know someone who used to know some people from Bangladesh who, even 30 years ago, 20 years ago, when this person from Bangladesh was young, their mother would say, you know, go, we need some lunch, so can you go to the river and get us some fish? And
right.
The person would catch fish for lunch, but the rivers have become polluted enough that no longer can this person's family subsist on the fish from the river. So
right.
One of the questions I wanted to ask you is, I understand that poaching is the primary problem, and I want to come back to that in a moment, but has pollution harmed fish populations, thus harming the otters as well?
Yes, I'll give you a slightly long answer to this, which is when I started my work, I was particularly drawn to otters because I believed they were a metaphor for what's happening to our rivers across India. Metaphors in more ways than one, because like you said, yes, pollution's a huge concern. That's very often not given attention to. But also things like agriculture, pesticides running off the fields, all sorts of things, dams. So I believed all of these would affect otters in turn. And like you said, yes, fishing, there's a lot of fishermen along the river for whom the livelihood is by catching fish. And almost unanimously, everybody agrees that they just cannot survive by fishing alone. And fish stocks have fallen all along the river, across most rivers, I would say. And they're not as profitable or as sustainable as they would have been at some point in time. But otters, while I thought would be good metaphors of how the rivers have actually been reduced to, have another, I would say, trick up their sleeve, which is otters are extremely resilient and highly adaptable. While fish populations have fallen and fishermen really feel the brunt of it, otters have survived primarily because they've adapted to this by taking fish from fishermen's nets, much to the dismay of the fishermen. So increasingly in many places where fishermen and otters coexist or share the same stretch of the river, it is very, very common to see otters learning how to take fish from fishing nets. It's an easy snack. Why wouldn't otters do it compared to hunting fish in murky waters, which is energetically very quite expensive? There is fish just sticking out of the net, and you just have to go get it when the fisherman's not looking at you. So this is how otters have adapted, I would say, in many places. But this has also had its repercussions, which is fishermen, a lot of the fishermen I've spoken to do not like otters or do not want otters in their stretch of the river, primarily because of this habit of taking fish from the net and in the process damaging the net. Fishing nets are somewhat expensive to repair or can't be repaired sometimes. Fish catch is gone. So a lot of the frustration for the fishermen that has many, many reasons. I'll elaborate here. So one of the main reasons for fish populations to have fallen is, one is, yes, pollution, which has had long-term impacts on fish populations, but also intensive sand mining, which has changed the very nature of our rivers, increasing number of dams, which have stopped fish migrations and movement, and intensive fishing itself. We shouldn't ignore the fact that fishing has been very intensive, highly unsustainable in many stretches. So all of these various factors have contributed to fish populations declining drastically. So for a fisherman along the river, it's very frustrating when he is not getting enough fish for these various reasons. But the only way he can vent this frustration is when otters start taking fish from his net. He Often fishermen also occupy the lowermost strata in our society here in India and probably in many countries in South Asia. Fishermen cannot confront the sand mining mafia. They cannot confront the dam builders. They cannot stop pollution and various other things. But what they can do is they can easily put the blame on otters. They can chase away otters, or they can, in some instances, club otters to death. They can get poachers to come and poach otters from their stretch of the river. So it's all really complicated how everything is tied to the other along the river.
Yeah, something similar happens in the United States where salmon populations are crashing because of dams, because of overfishing, because of all sorts of other reasons. And in response, there are those who want to kill the sea lions or kill harbor seals.
Right.
And harbor seals will take them right out of fishermen's nets, just same way as what you're talking about there.
Right.
And again, it's much easier to blame that than it is to blame the distant institutions that are putting in the mine or putting in the dams.
Yeah, exactly.
So before we move on, are there? I interviewed someone about king cobras and how the education that he has to do with cobras has to do mainly with telling people to wear rubber boots when they go outside at night or something like that. It was purely technical because cobras are respected in general in India, he was saying. And in the United States, I would contrast that with, in a lot of rural areas, a lot of ranchers really hate wolves. And so if we exclude the fishermen who are losing their livelihoods and blame otters, what is the relationship between – do people in India – I know that this is – they're not homogeneous like this, but are otters generally respected or hated, or – do people not even think about it for the most part?
So you're right. The king cobra that you were referring to enjoys a lot of tolerance with the communities that share the landscape. And that's because of, religion and just the fact that people recognize that this is such a large, powerful snake. And if left to itself, you don't really have any issues with it or problem with it. But when it comes to otters, apart from the fishermen, otters have generally been invisible to the larger communities. People mostly don't have an opinion, or people in cities, for example, don't even know that there are otters in India. Or a lot of people think otters are seals and seals that are in other countries. So otters have largely been invisible to the general public, but otters have also been invisible to policymakers, to enforcement agencies. So a lot of the conservation movement in India is pegged on these charismatic animals, carnivores, elephants, rhinoceros, which draw a fair share of the limelight and resources. Otters, unfortunately, just because of the habitat, which is rivers, don't enjoy or enjoy the same amount of protection and conservation resources needed. In India, very little of our rivers are protected by this network of protected areas, primarily because rivers are intensively settled, cultivated, and used. There has to be a model of sharing space and not a form of strict protection, since that's just not realistic here. Yeah.
So I want to, when you and I were communicating before we did the interview, one of the things that you had stressed to me was that it's really hard to talk about otters without talking about rivers. And I want to stop talking about otters for a moment. And I don't know how to say the name of this river, but I know that you, one of the rivers that you love is spelled Cauvery.
Yes, it's the Kaveri. Yeah.
Kaveri.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that river, what you love about it. I mean, I have never heard of it before. So can you introduce that river to us and sure. talk about the larger natural community of which it's a part?
Sure. So the Kaveri is special in many ways. The Kaveri River is one of southern India's largest rivers, but also it's a river that sustains, supports easily over 25 to 30 million people. And the river is also very interesting, not just because it supports so much life in human terms, but just to give you some background, the river Kaveri originates in what we call the Western Ghats. The Western Ghats is this really old mountain chain running parallel to India's west coast in southern India. And the river originates there and flows eastwards across ancient plains to flow into the Bay of Bengal. From source to sea, that would be approximately 800 kilometers, mostly split between two southern Indian states. The river Kaveri is highly revered by communities that live along because of its place in history and folklore. It's worshipped as a local goddess. But that doesn't mean people treat the river well. Well, there are a couple of days in a year when the river is worshipped and people gather at temples and shrines, but the rest of the year, that's easily forgotten and the river is trashed. But the river is important because the first 70 or 80 kilometers of the river flows through the foothills of the Western Ghats, which is largely dominated by coffee plantations, paddy fields, this mosaic of vegetation and agriculture and small towns. And after that is when the river flows into the drier plains, which see intensive agriculture. So the first initial headwaters of the river already sees these three otters sharing space. So it's not just the small-clawed otter, the Eurasian otter, and the smooth-coated otter, but this stretch of the river is also home to probably India's largest freshwater fish, which is the marshi. It's also home to the mugger crocodile. It just supports unbelievable biodiversity despite not being protected at all. And in the plains, this continues because the river is dammed, diverted and polluted, but somehow I still don't know how the river manages to do it. I'm sure there are scientific and rational explanations for it. The river still, in some sense, teems with life, be it otters or bird life, despite everything that's happening to the river itself. And it's interesting because the first 250 kilometers of the river is largely unprotected, heavily used, intensively farmed. And then it flows into this jewel of a protected area, which is called the Kaveri Wildlife Sanctuary. So the next 100 kilometers of the river is part of a protected area. And this protected area has probably India's finest, what we call riparian forest or riverside forest. So this is the stretch the river actually comes alive. It resembles a wild river despite being dammed upstream. The river is in its elements. And this is where otters, crocodiles, birds, elephants, tigers, everything shares space. And interestingly, no villages or people living along the river here. So it's the difference is stark. You have people living in the first 250 kilometers. For the next 100 kilometers, you don't have people. And the river just comes alive. It's stunning. So I was interested in understanding how these different ways of life or land use types, to use the right term, farming, habitation and a protected area, affect how otters themselves use the river and in turn how fishermen perceive otters. This is what actually drew me to this particular river. And yeah, that's just to give you a brief story of it.
So in that sanctuary, and again, this is one reason I want to ask you about this is because it's a major river, and we in the United States don't know anything about it. So, like, how wide is it in the sanctuary, and how deep maybe is it? Like,
okay, yeah,
go ahead.
So it varies. It's the habitat is quite diverse even within the sanctuary because it's a river valley with forests on the slopes. At the widest, so there are parts of the sanctuary which are very narrow gorges with just the entire river flows is funneled into a few meters, maybe 10, 15 meters, flanked by these tall, rocky gorges. There are other sections of the river which is easily 100 meters wide or more, with large sandbanks, slow-flowing water, large river pools, whirlpools, and rapids. So it's really, really diverse. And so the sanctuary is approximately 1,000 square kilometers in area. And the river is what holds everything together. It's like this strand of life in the middle, which the whole sanctuary depends on.
And let's talk about you for a moment. How did you come to love rivers, this river, and otters?
I think that it started close to 14 or 15 years ago when I was still a greenhorn. I was just out of college working with a wildlife NGO, not doing any river-specific or otter-specific research, but I was getting to spend a lot of time in the wilderness following animals, setting up camera traps, looking for tigers or elephants, or just living with the forest guards. That was when I first encountered otters. Strangely, it wasn't even in a river, but it was a dammed reservoir. So in India, a lot of the catchment for rivers, the headwaters and the hills around the reservoir are usually protected areas. So you have reservoirs that form part of the protected area. So that was when I first saw the smooth-coated otter, and I was like, wow, I know almost nothing about this animal. It was a really brief sighting. They disappeared immediately. But that was when I got really curious about them, and I felt they were a good way for me to understand the river. So just like how otters for me have been this model to understand what's happening to rivers, I also think there are other forms of life. For example, I now increasingly believe that fish eagles could be really good indicators for our riparian ecosystems or habitats in ways that otters cannot be. Otters are resilient by nature. They can adapt very well to modification. That's their strength. But fish eagles need very, very specific habitat requirements, like tall riverside trees for perching and nesting, less disturbance by people, these large pools teeming with fish. So I've always been looking for these species that help me understand the river more than I know. That's how I got introduced to otters, and
so you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but why, I mean, this is something that's been central to my work, and I don't understand it. Why do you care about rivers? Why do you love rivers and otters and these eagles? And it seems so many people don't. What is it that makes some of us love the natural world?
I don't think there's a direct answer to it. It's something I just grew up with. I've always been drawn to the wilderness. I've always loved spending time outdoors. And that's just in some ways crystallized into otters and fish eagles and the river and wildlife. And I see a clear link between wilderness and my own state of mental health. It's a very direct link. The more time I spend outdoors, the better I feel. and the better I'm able to cope with everything that's happening around me. So it's as simple as that. Time spent outdoors means a better way to understand life.
And, you know, in the introduction, in your bio, you had said that you use otters and rivers to talk about larger environmental issues and also your own struggles with mental health. And I think so many of us, on both a psychological and a physiological level, insofar as those can be separated, we feel so much better in nature. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Yeah. So it's so the difference for me is quite stark when I'm in the city without access to field or forests. It's just very different. I'm either kind of in some tasks, yeah, at certain times depressed or not curious about enough about life. But when I'm outside, when I'm in the forest or along the river, it's as simple as me needing all my senses. Everything has to be acute for me to be able to understand what's happening around me. I need to, it just takes my mind off myself in some sense. I don't think about myself, but I'm thinking about everything around me. I need to be alert to see what's happening. I need to be able to hear what's happening. I need to be able to it's just that you get lost in the habitat that you're in, that you have very little time to ponder over things pertaining to your own self. So for a long time, I've struggled with mental health. I've been somewhere on the bipolar spectrum. And apart from my doctor and my medication being very important to me, it's the things that have made all the difference for me have been time spent in the wilderness and my dog Noah, who actually reminds of wilderness to me, so he's very special. So yeah, I think without access to field, forests or rivers, life would be quite hard in the city. So
I'm just going to throw this out there, and you can respond however you want or not at all. And I know that when I used to go on tour a lot, I live in a forest, and when I used to go on tour, I would go into a city and then go to my hotel and shut the drapes and just stay in my hotel room until it's time for my event. And I would go to the event, and then when I get back, I just have to shut the hotel room because I feel like my skin has been abraded off by all the concrete and everything. And I would feel like I wasn't able to relax or fully breathe until I was back in the forest. Does that spark anything in you?
Yes, that's so true. That's very true. And it's a lot like the way I feel here. The only thing that makes life in the city bearable is, like I think I mentioned earlier, is that I live with this really wild dog, and he reminds me of a wild animal, and he makes life bearable. But it's true, I'm mostly stuck indoors. I don't feel like stepping out sometimes. It's just that I'm unable to read, I'm unable to write. There's just no inspiration when you are in the city, you know what's happening in the country, you know what's happening in the world. You just can't take in so much news. Life is just not simple the way it should be.
So we didn't talk in your bio, but I did hear about this before, that you teach a lot for you work on restoration issues, also, is it correct that you teach about rivers too, or is that not true?
Actually, neither of them directly. I I haven't done any, I've done probably very, very little hands-on restoration myself, but I'm a huge advocate for it because I think that's one way you're really going to change things, be it either river or a degraded landscape. Restoration is a huge part of conservation for me. And I've thankfully had time to interact with some of the best restoration practitioners here, and there's a lot I've learned from just interacting with them and being around the places they work in. Also, when it comes to teaching, I've just happened to be either along the stream or the river when a group has visited, and I've just taken them along. I don't do any in-class teaching really, but it's just that if I'm out in the field and somebody comes along and say, yeah, let's go for a walk, I take the group for a walk along the river or the stream.
But isn't that in some ways the most important sort of teaching?
I just see that as something coming naturally to me. I don't see it as something external. It's just me doing something I'm comfortable with, walking along a stream or a river, just that you have more people with you, you can talk, and everybody sees the stream in a different way, and it's nice to hear what they think about it, yeah, and share what you know.
Well, and also, yeah, exactly, that if you also, I know that when I go someplace with somebody who knows the river, I can learn so much more by them pointing out details that I would have missed because they're so familiar with it. And I just find myself, when I go to a river or go to a forest with somebody who loves it and right. who knows it fairly well, that is a really, for me at least, a really important form of teaching.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. I feel the same way too, especially with people who spent their entire lifetimes working in a particular landscape, and it's a completely different way of seeing things when you're out walking with them or you're out listening to what's happening around. It's a different way of learning that probably won't come to you directly. You can spend a lot of time there, but you still wouldn't see some things the way they see it, and that only comes by interacting with them.
Are there some specific stretches of river that you have visited and gotten to know over a long time?
I spent some time initially walking along not a large river, but a lot of small streams. I was looking for the small cloud otter because I was trying to understand how can these otters survive in a landscape that's changing so fast? So this landscape in the Western Ghats mountain chain has a lot of forest, but it also has a lot of forests that have now been converted to tea plantations. And I wanted to know, are otters, yes, I know otters are there in the forest, but I want to know if otters are also using the streams and the tea plantations. So, which meant I walked a lot of streams, both in forests and tea and coffee plantations. And I went to the landscape with preconceived notions. I said, look, tea plantations are so drastically different from these really large forests that there's surely going to be an effect on how otters use the landscape. And after my study, I was really shocked to see that otters use streams and tea plantations almost as intensively as streams and forests. That is something I totally didn't expect. And this is something I've found over the years in the different places that I visited, that I go there with a hypothesis and data shows that actually something else is at play. And what it's telling me is that otters adapt really well. Otters, if left to themselves, will survive. But that doesn't mean we destroy everything that we have. It means that while these animals are resilient and can adapt, well, they need space, they need habitat, they need fish or crabs. And the only way to bring elements of their habitat back is to restore what's left of these damaged or degraded habitats.
So we have about five or eight minutes left, and can you talk a little bit more about, first, what can be done about poaching, since you said that's a primary harm, and then what can be done to stop or slow the sand mining, and what can be done to make it so exactly what you just said can happen, so the rivers and thus the otters can recover?
Yeah. So while tackling poaching could be, I would say, the easier option of the two, India has a history of good conservation action or even enforcement. Tiger numbers have recovered. A lot of the prey numbers have recovered thanks to our protected areas. There's strong enforcement in many places. The only problem or issue for otters is that a lot of otters are found outside this network of protected areas where they are vulnerable. But it's still important that we work with the forest agencies to ensure that these otters outside also receive some form of protection. I don't see poaching wiping out our otters the way it is done in Southeast Asia, where otters have disappeared. I don't see that happening in India because there are lots of checks and there are lots of safeguards for that. Patrolling and enforcement can still be quite strict here. The real problem is sand mining. Sand mining is almost unchecked at the moment, and unless people in the cities like us say, yeah, we don't need that extra apartment, or we don't need a convenient, we don't need 6-lane highways or 12-lane highways or flyovers or skyscrapers, the demand for sand from the river is not going to stop. So as long as we want our cities to grow and we want a better, speedier and luxurious life here, sand mining will always happen along rivers. It's really, really, for me, a no-brainer. All the demand for the sand is coming from urban centers and the highways. And in fact, the economy of the country is driven in many ways by sand, much more than a lot of other minerals or resources. So as if the government kind of realizes how vulnerable our rivers are, how close we are to losing them just because of our thirst for sand, things don't look very good at the moment. Yeah, it's a hard case.
One of the things I love about this particular interview is how a river, one of the things that a river does is bring together the mountains and the plains and the ocean and the rain, and it sort of stitches everything together. And I love how in this interview you've done the same thing, where we move from otters to rivers to urban centers, to sand mining, and how you've been able to just sort of seamlessly move back and forth between them. And I think that that's really wonderful. And I think that that's, as well as talking about the topics themselves, I think that that's just such a great example of the way the natural world works and also of ecological thinking. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, yeah. It's just the way things are linked, and it's hard to look at one and not be aware of the other.
Well, is there anything else that you want to say about either otters, rivers, or NOAA before we go?
Oh, yes. NOAA is he's just a very special dog. I adopted him from a shelter, and he was rescued because he was severely abused and taken to the shelter. That's when I first met him, and he is just changed my life. He's saved my life a couple of times when I was at the worst of my mental health crises. He lives with me. He follows me around. He is a really empathetic dog. He's a fairly large-sized dog, and over the years, he's learned to trust everybody. He was very unpredictable when we first met, not towards me, but towards other people. And it's just amazing, just the way how a river kind of ties everything together. Noah performs a similar role in my life because just as he's important to me, he is important to my larger community of friends and well-wishers. There are some parallels there.
Well, thank you so much for all of that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Nisarg. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.